Accessing records from initial scanning date. Stand by.
Faith sustains us in the hour when reason tells us that we cannot continue, that the whole of our lives is without meaning.
We will rebuild the earth. Though it take us another 2,000 years, but this time, we will build it better.
This is how the world ends. Swallowed in fire, but not in darkness. You will live on. The voice of all our ancestors. The voice of our fathers and our mothers to the last generation. We created the world we think you would have wished for us. And now we leave the cradle for the last time.
Rest easy, friend.
From 1 million years into the future, catch a glimpse of what is to come.
That which you do not know.
On an all-new Babylon 5.
You have transmissions holding.
Batch incoming signal. Full audio and video decode.
Purple files accessed.
What you are about to see has never been shown to anyone outside the Break House.
Hello, everyone out there in podcast land. Welcome to Gray 17, a Babylon 5 podcast, a part of the Front Row Network and NPR Illinois Community Voices. We're a group of newbies watching Babylon 5 for the very first time, and a group of first ones who have watched Babylon 5 far too much. And we are here to discuss the season 4 finale, episode 22 of the season, The Deconstruction of Falling Stars, which everyone on this podcast loves. And I'm looking forward to the love fest that will be the talk of this episode as Kevin shakes his head at me and puts his head down. This is going to be fun. So I'm Scott, and with me is
Blake,
Nicole,
Emily,
Justin,
Mike,
and Kevin.
Jesse has not quit the show. She's lost her voice. I did ask her to come in and just grunt at us when she disapproved, and she said she wasn't going to do that. So she'll be back, everyone. Calm down. So before we get started with the talk of Deconstruction of Falling Stars, a reminder to click all the links down below. We have our social media links. We are active on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. On Twitter, we are doing currently our tournament for season 4, and we, as this drops, are in the final 4. The newbies don't know what the final 4 is yet, but we're down to those. And then we will be talking about the tournament when we do our live show in 2 weeks. So be sure to vote over on Twitter. On Facebook, there's a whole bunch of debauchery going on, as per usual. And if you can't get enough on the social medias, we also do have our Discord if you join our Patreon. A big thank you also to our great council members who are listed down below as our producers who provide the highest donation to our Patreon every single month. We really do appreciate it. Along with that, if you can, please make sure to like, subscribe, follow on both the podcast and the YouTube channel. As I just mentioned, we'll be talking live about season 4 here in 2 weeks. So be sure to click that notify bell icon on YouTube so you know when we go live, so you can join in, chat with us as we talk about the season. And then also, if you can, finally, please do leave a review either on Spotify, Audible, or Apple. Apple being the one that really does help us the most. And we did get a couple reviews in this week, but I'm going to read the 5-star that came from Chow001111. I looked it up, by the way. I guess it's a song, but it's Chow001111. And it says, nostalgic, but in a good way. I'm a first one who watches B5 when it first aired and have watched it many, many times since, in parentheses, except season 5. You newbies will understand why soon, in parentheses. I appreciate the analysis of your first ones, but especially enjoy the perspectives of your newbies, as I am unable to watch B5 with any objectivity and without taking into account the series as a whole at this point. Hearing the newbies, conjectures, and opinions takes me back to the endless debates my friends and I had when B5 first aired. Keep up the good work. Season 5 isn't that bad. Everyone calm down.
Well, everybody's setting it up to be a clunker, man.
Well, yeah. We also set up season one, and you all kind of somewhat enjoyed season one. I think it was still Emily's favorite season. She's not arguing with me.
Yeah, I don't think I can argue that.
Thanks, Chow, for leaving the review. If you can, anyone else, please do leave a review. Also, I received in the mail a couple items from a fan, and they asked us to give those away as giveaways. So if you are really a big fan of Windows 95 CD-ROMs, I've got a couple of them, and I'll be announcing that giveaway when we do our season 4 recap show live. And one of the giveaways will be for anyone who has left a review. So if you have not left a review yet on Apple, go in there and do that now so you'll be entered in for the giveaway. There'll be another giveaway too, because I got two. I'll figure that one out as we go as well. But if you have left a review already, or if you can, you will be entered into that contest, which we will announce in a couple weeks. So guys, we're going to dive in now to Deconstruction of Falling Stars, the final episode of season 4. And when we get started with this, we will go to our newbies first and ask for their first impressions. And then we'll talk to our first ones who have watched every episode and get their first impressions. And then we'll talk about the whole episode, which, by the way, this is probably the easiest episode to break up because it's vignettes. So we'll just do one vignette at a time. Before we get started, Justin, I believe you have a synopsis for us.
I do. Starting with the formation of the Interstellar Alliance, we get a glimpse into the future as we see how Babylon 5 and its crew are viewed through the lens of the coming centuries and millennia, showing us just how much and little humanity has changed over time, and just about how batshit crazy the future can be. And we get a very interesting viewpoint into Centauri weddings, which is very relatable.
Let's go ahead and get first impressions, Den. I'll go to Emily first. First impressions.
Infection was better.
This actually refers to Infection a little bit too, but we'll talk about that later.
I spent most of this episode wondering why I was still watching it and basically just annoyed.
Nicole, first impressions.
All right, so you know I'm usually one of those, even if it's not that great, it's not bad. I didn't enjoy this episode. I will say this is probably one of the first ones I can say that I was kind of like, over. It wasn't terrible, but like, I just didn't like it. I don't know if it was just the way it was set up or if it was just how things laid out in the future that I didn't like. I don't know. At first I was like, okay, this is kind of cool. And I'm like, okay, this is all right. I'm like, all right, like what can we like keep change something here? Like, is there going to be a B plot? Is there something else coming? Like, it wasn't terrible. There was some good lines in it, some good quotes. They quoted the Old Testament, which is kind of hilarious to me. Another Bible reference from the atheist. Which is even funnier. And then there was a couple other things that I picked out, like, you know, Jakar, his one-liner, perhaps everything you say is what they're questioning Londo, basically calling him out. And there was a quote about faith at the end, and I really liked that quote. I wrote it out, but we could talk about it later. Overall, I just thought it was weird. The whole reprogramming thing, that was weird. I will say, even after Garibaldi is dead, he's still a sneaky little guy. So that was kind of interesting. I really don't know what my thoughts are on this episode. It wasn't my favorite. I probably would skip it on the rewatch. I'll just say that.
Justin.
I think I actually have the exact opposite opinion of Nicole on this. I started it not liking it. Like, I felt like, were we sitting there watching an episode of the McLaughlin Group in that very first scene? And I was like, okay, this is going to be tiresome really quick. But as it went on, I actually started to enjoy it more and more. Specifically, like the 500 year through 1 million mark, I was actually getting kind of engrossed into what they were trying to portray and say about, you know, another Earth Civil War. And then especially the 1 million mark, I was sitting there like flabbergasted at some of the things that we saw there. I guess this show must have been renewed by this point. When this episode was filmed, because I liked the giant middle finger JMS gave everybody right at the end there. I chuckled out hysterically with it. Just one thing to kind of follow up on from my synopsis. I really liked the description. I when they were kind of walking in and the wedding and all that stuff and the celebration, and you know, Londo walks in and says, "Oh, who died?" And they had to kind of explain to him what was happening. And he was like, "Centauri weddings are somber affairs with moments of reflection, regret, and recrimination. My first wedding must have been a Centauri wedding." So those of you who were there can understand.
The wedding itself was fun.
Right.
The partner, not so much. No, I had a great time.
The wedding was fun.
The reception was fun. The wedding, he's right on the first
part. Okay.
The wedding,
The reception was a great time. Now, everything after that?
Yeah. Anywho.
Justin, so. you just invoked the McLaughlin group, and I gotta tell you, 0.1% of our audience are Gen Zers, and they have no fucking clue what you just talked about. It's only 0.1%, though, so we're fine.
And now all I can do is picture Dana Carvey doing the McLaughlin group on SNL.
That's exactly what I was going to reference, Kevin. Go back and look up Dana Carvey's on SNL doing the McLaughlin group, and you'll never watch that scene the same way again.
I'm actually impressed that 0.1% of our audience is under 17.
Yeah. I mean, I was actually picturing Crossfire from CNN with Tucker Carlson before he went completely batshit nuts.
And Paul Begala.
Yeah, and John Stewart going on there and basically telling them they were ruining America.
Stop hurting us. Stop.
It was bussin'.
Thank you, Mike.
John Stewart had the riz.
I was gonna say he had the riz.
What the fuck are you all saying?
No cap.
I want to point out, 47% of our audience is over 45, so we don't need to do that too much.
So we'll please translate.
Them. We'll confuse them.
I don't even know what they said. So
I don't either. I don't know what's going on.
All tea, no shade.
Okay, let's go to our first ones who have watched every single episode and talk to Mike about his first impressions.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Not fun. Not fun to watch. Actually downright cringy at times. I don't hate all of it. I think there are some endearing moments, particularly the section with Roy Brocksmith, which we'll talk about later. I thought was pretty fun, but everything else, man, is just all a bunch of cringe leading up to the eventual revelation that the Moo Moo makes a comeback and then humans turn into Vorlons. So not great. Not great, Bob.
Thanks, Bob. Kevin.
Yeah, don't like this episode. As you might guess, I'm going to be really quiet about it. I don't hate the entire episode. It does have some good points. I thought Nicole put it really well. There was, you know, a couple of funny lines and some stuff near the beginning. And, you know, the idea that we knock down our heroes for either our own selfish reasons or, you know, what have you, you know, talking heads is almost never a great look for, you know, talking about our issues at hand or history or whatever, in this kind of context. All of that is interesting. I'll get to a more reasoned explanation of why I don't like this episode, but suffice it to say, the whole computer program came alive and saved the day stupidity was just absolutely ludicrous. And the fact that we're going to go through a probably thousand year, you know, dark ages again, where there was apparently still gasoline around in 700 years from now is really fucking stupid. So this episode, the writing is terrible. It was clearly rushed. It's not the direction. It's not the makeup. It's not the acting. It's the writing. I don't like it, and I don't think it's good.
Well, on the gasoline point, I mean, it's 30 some odd years later and Walking Dead is still making that mistake. So
they actually clearly say why there's still gasoline, but we'll talk about it when we talk about it. They clearly
it's
say
still
why.
Stupid, but okay, let's go.
Blake.
So I actually like this episode and I like it for a few reasons. One is, and Emily, you mentioned Infection was better, which is kind of funny to me because the very end of Infection and you've got Sinclair talking to a reporter about the cost of going to space and why should mankind go to space. And the thing Sinclair says is because someday our sun will go and wipe out Earth. And if we don't go to space, everything we are, everything we have, everything we've learned, contributed goes with it. We go to the stars to preserve all of this. So I like that this episode ties back to that in a way where you've got Earth sun going Nova and is going to wipe out Earth. So they're getting everything off. So I kind of like that symmetry of tying back, which Infection aired fourth, but it was actually the first episode filmed after the gathering. So it kind of, to me, put a nice bookend on what would have been the first episode filmed for season one and this episode as the ender to season four. So I like the symmetry of that. But I also like the pieces where it was mentioned that JMS is an atheist. And you see in this episode the way he's able to weave religion and faith in, which I've commented a lot how skillfully he's done through this series, but even in the background, when Sheridan and Delenn get back to B5, there's someone holding a sign, Sic Transit Gloria Mundus, which is the line, which is what they say to the new Pope when they elect a new Pope, that worldly glory or fame is transitory. It doesn't last. So you've got someone holding that sign when Sheridan and Delenn arrive back, and we've commented, they've kind of made Sheridan at times into this messianic figure. So you see references to that. You see references to that when they do this hop into the future, and you've got the monks working on the illuminations, and it's all about the Rangers and the story of Sheridan and Delenn. So I like the way the pieces tie together and where it shows out into the future. And it does leave a bit of mystery, too, because they even say with Earth's sun going no supernova, and we'll get into this later, is where they say it's anomalous solar flares. So this isn't even like the natural, you know, it's the sun's time. They even allude to there could be more of a mystery here. And I just like the way they set it up and the way they did it.
Yep. This is one of my favorite episodes of the show. Not the favorite, but one of my favorites for several reasons. Blake, you hit on a lot of it. I love the through line throughout this is an idea of hope, but also the idea that history moves its own way. And you can't have a singular person to, you know, completely right the ship and make everything hunky-dory, but individuals do have an impact on what's going on. They definitely reference Foundation, and if you've read the first couple books of Foundation, the whole idea of psychohistory, and you can map out the future just by statistics and sociology, and individuals don't matter. Which, of course, then later in the Foundation books, they flare out that individuals absolutely do matter for other reasons. But this is kind of hitting on a kind of middle ground. It's not individuals, but it's not society. It's a little bit of both. History is going to move where it needs to move, but you can kind of put a little speed bump in the way and get it to move a little bit, which I appreciate. And I also like the fact that this is really just a couple Twilight Zone episodes tied together. JMS is a huge fan of Twilight Zone. He actually has been involved in later iterations of the Twilight Zone. And you can definitely feel that, especially, Kevin, to your point, the last two vignettes, the 500 years and the 1,000 years into the future. It's extremely Twilight Zone-y. And then to Blake's point, I love the fact that, yeah, we're going to fall on our asses a couple more times, but at the end of the day, we make it. The human race will become the next first ones for whomever comes next. And I think that is a idea of hope that comes through. And finally, it's kind of harder sci-fi than what we're used to. It's not poppy sci-fi. It's not serialized, obviously. There's some more heavy tones to this. And I think it's well-written. I'm looking forward to having a conversation about it because I think this is really well-written. But we'll dive into it. And as I mentioned, the nice thing about this is we can just take the vignettes one at a time. So let's talk about the prologue, I guess is the easiest way to put it first, when we're back on B5 right after Rising Star and Delenn and Sheridan are having their lovely return. Anyone want to talk about that? Talk about Londo, Jakar, or anything else before we jump ahead a few years?
I already said my piece on that subject.
Cool. Nicole?
I was just going to say, I thought it was kind of interesting that Garibaldi was back and one of the ones that was helping throw the party, and Sheridan was like, I'm gonna find a way to get you back. The whole gang was back together on B5, so that made me feel happy. I think that was probably one of my favorite scenes of the whole show so far. I mean, there's a couple other things that we could talk about, but I really enjoyed that, and I enjoyed that, like, they not only were celebrating them, but like just celebrating in general. Like, it was a celebratory vibe on Babylon 5. And it made me feel really good.
Yeah. You said the gang's all there. Not all the gang.
Well, except for Ivanova, but.
Did you all notice the intro?
Yes.
Okay.
I was like, the intro is different, but Marcus was still in it.
Yeah.
So I was confused.
So it's a contractual thing. We'll just have to leave it there unless you want to get into it more, but it's a whole thing.
Justin.
I mean, I would like to hear about the contractual thing later on at some point when it becomes relevant. But to kind of piggyback off of something Nicole said about Garibaldi and Sheridan saying, oh, I'll have to find a way to get you back for all this. My thought when watching that scene, the couple times I watched this episode, was I think Sheridan has a lot more to get Garibaldi back for than just throwing him a wedding party. So I wonder, to me, the relationship between those two seemed a lot more friendly than I would have expected coming out the gate, but that could very well change throughout the next season.
Emily?
I just need to bitch about Sheridan's hair. I hate the slick back look. Like, scruffy Sheridan was fine, but the slick back hair with that facial hair, oh, no, sir. No, thank you. And honestly, I was annoyed that they got married because I just don't like how they change her personality when she's around him. It still pisses me off.
Emily, don't look any pictures up of me from 2003 then. Because that's exactly the type of style I was rocking back then.
He had a little bit of the salt and pepper, Justin, and you're all good to go.
He also has that look of doom, but that's a whole different,
reason for that. The facial hair, the slicked back hair. Yeah, it was like, oh, that was kind of my style from back then.
I don't know. Like, something about it just doesn't feel like it fits. Like, there are some people who can have that style and you're like, no, that's cool. It works on them. But for him, I don't know.
The one thing I want to hit on with this, and it actually goes throughout the entire show, but this is a good place to start because obviously they're doing the ISN thing a little bit. But Kevin, you mentioned that your issue was not the director. Did anyone catch who the director is in this episode?
I did.
Well, I would hope so, Mike.
I did not.
I don't pay attention.
Great. That's Emily, thank you for that.
I didn't pay attention to the credits, so.
It was our good buddy Veer, Stephen First.
Oh, okay.
And we'll get into it more when we get to the monk scene, but JMS had a lot of fun giving Stephen a whole bunch of shit while making this episode. But the whole idea is, of course, in every one of these, there's a little bit of different direction going through it. And so First had a little bit of fun with this direction, too.
Yeah, and they filmed this episode in 6 days, which is a different schedule than they've been filming the first four seasons. TNT moved them to a 6-day schedule, which was particularly tough on JMS. The actor said it wasn't that huge a deal. It was probably the worst for wardrobe and writing, but this was only, this was the one of the first times they did the six-day schedule. So it was definitely a big change for them.
And at the
what
same
was time, it before that?
7.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So they cut a day off of it.
Yeah.
TNT had to pay for wrestling.
Yeah, they wanted to save some money, so they decided to move it to a 6-day schedule.
Okay, let's jump ahead a year to the McLaughlin Group.
Yeah, I thought it was more Meet the Press, but yeah, still garbagey.
Emily, tell us how you really feel about this episode.
It would be impolite, and I don't want to upset JMS that much.
Because you were always polite. Nicole, speaking of polite, what do you got?
Not that polite. I felt like I was watching a bad Fox News episode. I was like, what is happening right now? That one guy, he was going hard at Sheridan, saying that he's power hungry and all that. And the senator was like, yeah, you were a speechwriter for Clark. You know, she called his ass out. And I was like, get it, girl, get it. I think out of all of them, I liked her the best. And then the middle guy, he was good too. But that one guy in the end who just kept screaming, oh, I wanted to punch him in his face. And like, it was, I almost thought it was like, I don't want to say it was an exaggerated example of a news show, because unfortunately that actually does happen. It was kind of almost a prediction of what news shows would be like today. Also, this might be off the cusp here, but like, I noticed that all the dates were the same date, just different years. Is there a significance to that? I mean, I know I probably should wait till questions, but like, I didn't know if there was a significance to that date because I wrote them all down.
The robot or automated, whatever it was, said that she was pulling information from the same date at different time frames.
Okay. So that's just, I didn't know if it was a reason or if it was just a random date that was pulled.
Justin.
To me, the most interesting part of this whole sequence is, yeah, you know what? The Steve Bannon on the end was douchebaggy. The fact that Clark's party still has pull within Earthdome, and they made a reference to it being an election year and that he was just saying a lot of this stuff to gain electoral support, to me was kind of troublesome that Clark's party could still have a chance to get a majority in the Senate. So like, there's still a lot of Clark supporters out there. And I know we talked about this, if not the previous episode, but maybe a couple episodes ago, about how much of Clark's influence is still within EarthGov. And sadly, it seems like it's still quite a bit. So I thought that was an interesting kind of tidbit to come out of there.
You see Steve Bannon, I see Stephen Miller, but same idea.
Oh, yeah, very true. I thought it was interesting that the overall mood of the entire show was not very optimistic. Like, even the senator and the guy from Mars were very vocal in saying, I don't know if this is going to work, and even maybe skeptical that it's going to work, but at least they're willing to give Sheridan a shot at trying to make it happen, versus the third guy who's like, he's going to fail, and he's going to burn it all to the ground, and he's just a megalomaniac, and he's just a, you know, batshit crazy person and all that stuff. So we're only a few weeks into this, you know, the existence of the Interstellar Alliance. So it really doesn't surprise me that people are a little bit skeptical about whether or not it's going to work, but at least there's still enough support to be like, well, you know what? Give him a shot and see what he can do with it.
Kevin.
Yeah, I thought this was the most realistic part of the episode. And to this point in the episode, I don't really have a problem with it. Three guesses what political party that third guy would belong to in our timeline, but whatever. You know, the Mars stuff, you know, is kind of interesting. You know, they're, you know, it's unclear how that's all going to shake out. It seemed like that second guy from, I think he was in the middle, was from Mars, or at least had been. So that aspect I thought was interesting. But yeah, up until this point in the episode, I don't find it objectionable, but then the wheels fall off.
I swear I'm not saying this just to piss you off, Kevin.
Yes, you are.
But no, I'm seriously not. This is the weakest part of the show for me, of the episode, because there's not much to it. I mean,
no, there isn't.
We get it every single day on any kind of talking head station. You know, it was mentioned Fox News, MSNBC and Fox, and MSNBC at this point was more hard CNN, but they came out in 96, fall of 96. This came out in 97. So I think it's absolutely talking about how we're kind of moving into 24-hour news networks and everything else. Anybody else on the first vignette? Let's jump ahead 100 years. Nicole?
The most disturbing part to me was the video with Garibaldi. And I don't know who was on the other end, but I assume it was the terrorist that Sheridan was threatening. You know, here's Garibaldi. You can't see who he was talking to. He's like, if you work with me, I can help you out. And, you know, being Garibaldi, bartering a deal, which is what he does. And they fucking straight up executed him. And that, like, I gasp. I mean, they didn't show it, but you know what happened. And like, my heart broke a little because, as we all know, I do love Garibaldi. So I was like, what a shitty way for him to go out, man, because he is just, to me, one of the best characters. And like, it just really upset me that like that was his fate, killed by some random rogue fucking assholes, which I could be wrong. I don't know who he was killed by, but I'm assuming that's who, because, you know, once that Sheridan said, you have 10 minutes, we're not bartering, then, oh, there goes Garibaldi. But then here comes old Delenn, old and gray, just fucking letting him have it verbally. And the one guy starts to kind of combat her, and she just looks at him, and he shuts up. And I was like, that's right, bitch. You take it.
Justin.
I mean, honestly, it's not super surprising to me that they would go to a lot of pain and effort to try and discredit Sheridan and Delenn and everything that they're trying to accomplish in the formation of the Alliance, because that's what tends to happen throughout history, is once you get enough time separating the events, you have people. I mean, we do it with our history all the time. We go back and we analyze it and say, well, this person really didn't have an effect on this person. Well, this person we thought was a hero was actually an asshole, and so on and so forth. And it makes a lot of sense from a quote unquote, I guess you can say, another talking head aspect, where they want to discredit everything Delenn and Sheridan accomplished while still blaming them for directly for everything that went wrong. But it was a good glimpse into something we knew was coming, was the telepath war. And I think that's what they were referencing in the scene with Garibaldi. And there's a lot more to that story that we have not seen. And I hope we kind of get to that throughout season five, or maybe we learn what happened with telepath war, because Sheridan basically sacrificing someone who was supposed to be at one point his friend. So that was stone cold from Sheridan's part, willing to sacrifice Garibaldi to end this whole situation. But the couple questions that arise, and I'll reiterate them later when we get to questions and predictions, was, what are, you know, the one thing I didn't understand was like the mysteries surrounding Sheridan's death. or anything like that. Like, that was referenced by that one lady where she said, well, we all know he died on Mimbar, but there's these other stories about how he died that are out there that we don't really understand. And it's not like it was that long ago. It was only 80 years. And then what happened, she directly references the situation with their son. And we're talking about David. So to me, that's a big another question mark that I hope gets answered in season 5 is what was the situation with David and why 80 years after the fact, where David is probably, if he's still alive, he's an old man, but likely from the way they were talking, he's even not alive anymore. So what happened with David that would cause this to be worthy of a historical context?
Kevin.
Justin, I thought you put that really well, much better than I could have. I like the through line in this episode. It's probably the only thing that I really do like about it. It's the horrible tendency that we have of tearing down our heroes. And I think JMS really illustrates it. He puts it in a light that's very infuriating, you know, on purpose, to make a point. And I think that point is well taken. But the fact, let me preface what I'm about to say by saying that I like that the makeup for Mira Furlan in that scene is really great. She's good in it. It may even be a little too short, although it was more impactful because it was short. And I liked her acting in that. But it doesn't make sense that she was there. She lives in seclusion on Mimbar. They said that, or they were pretty sure she did, which is the only thing that makes sense. And then all of a sudden she's on Earth, you know, giving them a hard time about what they're saying, which they, of course, deserved. It feels like sloppy writing to me. It doesn't make sense. That being said, though, I still kind of like it, even with that.
There's nothing written down. JMS hasn't commented on it. This is truly my headcanon, just to help with that little plot hole that you brought up, Kevin. If you look at the table, there are 4 spotlights and only 3 people sitting at them. And the moderator seems to be somebody who at least is not as anti-Delenn Sheridan as the other ones. So in my head, and there's nothing written about this, I think he invited her and he just didn't know if she was going to show or not. So I think she was invited to be a part of the panel. And that's how I get past the fact that, yeah, she just, you know, spontaneously teleports from wherever she was to there. But I think those 4 spotlights do help at least to grease my headcanon a little bit. Justin.
Well, and I agree that it makes sense that he would invite her and wasn't 100% sure if she would show up or not. But I'm not even 100% sure they're on Earth, because they made the comment, well, you traveled all this way just to say that. And she makes the comment, well, you traveled just as far to say nothing.
Yeah.
So they could be on a colony somewhere. They could be who knows what planet or what station or wherever they're on. And you can tell even then when she does actually walk in and she's standing before them, the awe and reverence then that they still have for her, even when that one guy says, well, this is something that we would just expect you to say. And then like Nicole says, she just gives him that look. And that's the look of someone who knows that I'm in charge. She has had decades of dealing with all of this stuff. I've seen all of this with my own eyes. And she just gave him a look and he just shut up because he knew he had nothing left to say or come back at her with, because they all knew at that moment that they were all in the wrong.
Yeah, and Justin, to your first point, it sure would have been nice if they had a little crawl at the bottom, but that was Mimbar and that was the Alliance headquarters, which they mentioned in the last episode that they were going to spend time at B5 while the Alliance was building its headquarters. And so when the moderator says that it's been 100 years and that of the Alliance, and then it shoots to that building. So you can assume that's the Alliance headquarters.
Gotcha.
But still, she can move around really quickly, to Kevin's point.
Yeah.
Nicole.
Well, to Kevin's point and to, you know, your point, Scott, listen, sometimes you got to defend your man. You got to come out of hiding and you got to, you know, somebody be talking about my man, I'm going to cut them. Okay. So go Delenn, defend your man, girl. But anyway, that's just me being obnoxious. But what I was really
and when you're defending your man, bring 2 people with triangles with bells.
Yes.
It just seems
that's
like
2 venues away, Justin. That's not now.
It just seems like such a thin-skinned thing to bother like doing at
at her age of like 170 or whatever to like to just show up to this lecture of idiots talking and being like, I heard you was talking shit.
I mean, you when know, you're like... 107, you're not going to come defend your wife? No. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding.
Nicole, did you have a second point before Mike rudely interrupted you?
I did. Sorry. That's okay. That's okay. So Justin said something that I don't know if I necessarily agree with. He said that it was stone cold of Sheridan to basically sacrifice Garibaldi. But did he? Did like... We don't know if he knew Garibaldi was a hostage. Like, we don't know if, like, we don't know what happened. All we saw was that one scene. You know what I mean? So I don't know if he necessarily sacrificed Garibaldi. I just think.
Oh, I'm sure he knew because I'm sure they would have been like, we have Garibaldi, so this might be a better bargaining chip. I cannot believe he wouldn't be aware of it.
But I don't think he would like purposely like let them take Garibaldi out. You know what I mean?
Nicole, this is going to go into those. You love pointing out tropes or asking if they're tropes. Yeah. This is a trope.
Okay.
But it's actually legitimate. Yeah. And that is there's a lot of stories about presidents, especially United States presidents, who have to make hard decisions because it actually is international policy for most countries not to negotiate with terrorists. To what Sheridan says, if we open that door even once, we'll never be able to close it again. So does he know Garibaldi's there or not? I don't know at this point. But if Sheridan allows whatever this terrorist organization to get what they want, and that's his like first dealing with terrorists as the alliance, he's opening a door. So
yeah, it just makes me sad.
Like,
well, I want to go back to something Mike mentioned with Delenn and kind of seeming odd that Delenn would just show up and want to have this argument, but I kind of look at it as this is just a point in time. I'm kind of assuming behind this that there's been other instances where this kind of anti-alliance, anti-Sheridan narrative has started emerging. Like, this was not the start of it. It had been brewing for a while before this point in time. And to me, that's kind of why Delenn finally hit this fuck it point of, I'm going to go have some words here versus the, you know, it's not the first time where, oh, look, it's a panel that wants to, you know, have this stupid little conversation. This has been going on for a while. There's these so-called academics, which we even see that now with academics. I mean, you watch the news and you get these people with titles of doctor or whatever that are on the news just spouting this completely random off-the-wall nonsense on any number of subjects. You have it anywhere from international relations to vaccines and other health related issues. You've got these people that proclaim to be academic experts that are just spouting bullshit. And at a certain point, someone has to go start trying to correct the narrative.
That's one of my favorite scenes from The West Wing when Bartlett calls out the PhD. What'd you get your PhD in? Philosophy? Sociology? English literature? Oh, okay.
And then proceeds to beat the shit out of her with a Bible.
Yes.
You know, quite honestly, I that was exactly my thought watching that was like, oh, these are some people that really love to hear themselves talk. And the last time I thought that about somebody, it was when I was subjected to a Jordan Peterson talk. So you're spot on with your analysis there.
And to Justin and Blake's point a little bit too, I have a degree that I don't use in history, and my minor was poli-sci, so I can guarantee you in every single history and poli-sci department in the world, there are these assholes who are talking about how, oh, well, what you know about history is just propaganda, and it's all blah, 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 and we make these heroes up, blah, blah, blah. Every freaking poli-sci and history course ever, these assholes are there. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's so true. My second management job, they tried to scare me off. They're like, do you think you can handle this like super arrogant guy, you know, as a manager? And I said, I was a political science major. I've seen 1,000 of them. And yes, I can handle him. And he was gone within 3 months.
I was going to swing back to the whole negotiating with terrorists plot point, just because I feel like it's worth saying, you know, we've had these incidences like pretty recently where U.S. citizens have been taken captive in foreign nations, and these sort of things get politicized, which is really disgusting to me and yet not at all surprising. And it's always a case of, depending on who it suits, you know, wow, this guy did everything he had to do to get this person back, or oh my god, what a stone cold murderer he was for doing nothing to get that person back. And in this case, you know, it's like, what, that is such an idiotic view that it would be Sheridan's fault that he didn't get Garibaldi back. Never mind the terrorists who captured him and put him in that position. It's Sheridan's fault. Ridiculous.
Yeah, they seemed almost sympathetic to the terrorists during that entire scene.
It's all just spin to make it good or bad, depending on who they're trying to vilify.
And Tweedle Dipshit 1 did say that Sheridan even said it was his biggest mistake laying the telepath colony beyond Babylon 5. But again, this is the guy bashing on Sheridan the whole time. So did Sheridan actually say that?
And the bottom line is maybe he did and maybe he didn't. But there's obviously going to be more to the story than just that. You know, I mean, at a point in time, maybe it was the only choice, the only humane choice that Sheridan could make. We don't know.
All I know is if you watch that scene again, those terrorists had fabulous hair. They were all very long, very straight. And
Children of the Corn right there, man.
The other thing I wanted to throw out with this, and I'll talk more about in the next scene, which I know Kevin loves, is I think this is some of Jerry Doyle's best performing between this vignette and the next vignette. I love what he's doing here. I love his deadpan reaction to when Sheridan pops up. He's like, oh, good. He just puts his head down like, I'm fucked. I think Jerry's doing great in this episode for the two vignettes he's in. Okay, let's do the woo-doo-doo-doo and move on to 500 years in the future when we talk about Nazis. Blake, Nazis.
So one of the things I like with this, and I didn't mention it in my intro, but you talked about going to the Foundation series. This one also pulls in Orwell with 1984 and this whole idea of doublespeak and good facts that they have within this one really gets into that Orwellian piece. But even looking at the narrative now with certain individuals in politics, and trigger warning for all those listening to us that hate it when we do this, buckle up, buttercup, because when you have a candidate who literally is standing there telling a different version of facts to their supporters and saying, this is the true version, this is the truth of the facts, that everyone else is sitting there going, no. This is happening now. And this just takes it to an all new level where they're pulling in these historic figures. And what really gets me with this section, especially now, and it hit me more on this rewatch than it has in the past, where they're pulling in these holographic figures and reprogramming them, thinking about what we can do with AI now and what's out there and how easy it could be to manipulate historical figures, historical references. We mentioned TikTok the other day. I saw a thing on there that had a AI representation of Reagan. Now, it was a bad one. You could tell it was AI, but it had Reagan saying things that Reagan never said. So this one hit home a lot more for me based on, one, I'm a fan of Orwell, but also just looking at where this gets to in terms of good facts and inconvenient facts and this whole idea of reprogramming historical figures to fit current narrative. And just how dangerous of a slope that is, you know, here with holograms, but even thinking about generative AI now and where that could go.
Justin.
Well, and I thought, I mean, 100% like I was still totally watching this, getting Orwellian vibes to it. You know, not only is you have good facts, but you have the true facts, you know. And so even like that guy acknowledges like what they're spinning and concocting to show their version of things isn't true, but it's helpful to the narrative of the people who want to be in power. We later find out they're not in power. Earth is in the middle of a civil war, but they're trying to spin everything and even concocting this whole scene of, you know, Sheridan being a conqueror and the whole purpose of the alliance was to go out and, you know, create a new empire and execute a bunch of innocents along the way, and a billion deaths are worth it if we can achieve our objectives. And then where they manipulate Franklin to basically show him to be a Joseph Mengele of Babylon 5, where he's experimenting with children and trying to, you know, make some kind of hybrid race that would further achieve the objectives of the Interstellar Alliance, and just kind of rewriting this history to fit their own narrative. And it's the same arguments that we heard during the Clark regime. Humans have lost their uniqueness. They were being polluted by, you know, outside ideas. And, you know, the whole purpose of this is to undermine everything that the Alliance stands for, while trying to prove, you know what, we're the people that are in the right. And we even saw in the previous segment about trying to, in his own words, deconstruct the people who put this whole thing into place. So it's just taking everything that was in that second segment and now taking it one step further into actual practice. And I thought it was very touching, the very last scene of that before the place gets bombed, where he walks over and just says, "Rest easy, friends, rest easy." Where, like, it to me, that to me what had a good emotional moment that I really enjoyed.
Nicole.
Well, first, what I didn't like was it was really uncomfortable watching Franklin talking about testing on the children and all that stuff. That was really fucked up. And then Sheridan basically screaming like a lunatic and making people shoot each other. Like, that really, it was like so out of character for both of them. So it made me very uncomfortable to watch. I did not like it. Obviously, I know they were programmed to do that and it was holograms or whatever, but it really was just like, that's fucked. Like, the whole concept of what he was doing, reprogramming and deconstructing, that was fucked up. Like, and like Blake said, with AI today, it really creeped me out. Like, it really, really creeped me out. And I was very unsettled watching that. I did also like how Garibaldi basically was like, motherfucker, guess what? I told everybody what you were doing. And even though it was like a hologram and he was like reprogrammed, I just thought it was so fitting and like so, I don't know. It just made me laugh. Like, he literally was created by this asshole. Oh, and also that scientist guy or whatever, it's kind of a dumbass. As he's going along, he's literally telling them what he's doing. Yeah, okay, maybe you're lonely in your little science lab, so you're going to talk to the holograms. I don't know if, but like, I just thought we were given Sheridan shit for being kind of a dumbass. And then here comes this guy who's just saying it all out loud, like, bro, like, you shot yourself in the foot. And then literally they get nuked. So, but I also enjoyed the whole rest easy, friends. It just kind of was like, oh, man, like, now they're all going to die all over again together. Like, it just made me sad. But it was a very like touching moment.
Now I'm just wondering what other holograms Nazi boy uses to help him from being lonely.
Yeah, it was just so creepy. Ugh, ugh. He's probably making a sex doll, like a Marcus sex doll.
He probably has an Ivanova hologram.
Yeah.
It's about the same time period, actually.
I mean, I wouldn't mind an Ivanova hologram.
You heard it here, folks. You heard it here first. Kevin, what you got?
I don't know how I'm going to follow that one up. So I agree that the final part of the scene, you know, was very touching, you know, the whole rest easy friends. And I definitely, you know, saw the Orwellian theme and liked that part of it. And the AI stuff really did hit differently this rewatch for sure. I agree, Blake. What I don't like is the idea that they would have any thought process of bringing a computer program that was so self-aware in 500 years that they would be able to completely annihilate, or at least almost completely annihilate, the human race with the touch of a few computer buttons. The fact that he did not need Garibaldi when he put Delenn on hold didn't make sense, that he didn't put them both on hold. Of course, it doesn't fit for the way that the scene was written, because you need Garibaldi not to be, so that he saves the day. All of that is just ludicrously stupid, and I didn't like it on Star Trek when they did it, but they did it a hell of a lot better than they did in this episode. It's ludicrous. It's the worst part of this episode, and it probably colors my view of the rest of the episode because it's so goddamn dumb.
Justin?
I think that the way the guy, and Nicole, you made a mention of the way that this guy was acting throughout the entire thing. They even said himself later on, this whole thing was an act of desperation. It wasn't something that was that they had time to sit down and really think about and plan about. They were on the verge of war and they had to get something done and get something done quick. So they probably took a lot of liberties that under a normal circumstance they wouldn't have taken. So like, the guy sitting there telling Garibaldi his entire plan, why wouldn't he? Because I'm going to be deleting this program anyway. You're not going to know any of it. Who are you going to tell? In his own mind, not realizing he actually did shoot himself in the foot by programming these things to be a little too intelligent. But at the same time, he's playing like a typical fascist stooge. Garibaldi comes to him being like, I have a lot of in-depth knowledge about these guys that can help you out, and I can get you the information that you need. And I'm the guy that actually was the brains behind the entire, you know, the the entire operation. Don't you maybe want a promotion out of this? And that's what piqued his interest, because if you look at any kind of totalitarian regime like that, any information or anything you can do to get yourself that much closer to the inner circle is worth doing. So if he can come back to them and say, I've got all of this great information about how we can possibly end up winning this whole thing, could end up being very good to him in the long run and well worth the risk of what he's trying to do. So to me, it's, you know, it's the finesse in the writing. And I think Kevin will 100% disagree with me saying there's no finesse in this. But I think there is a finesse in the writing with this, because it shows just how the whole scene was a bumbling mess because it was supposed to be that way. Not only in this current historical time, but throughout all of public human history, the war of public opinion is just as important as the war on the battlefield.
Like,
so in Kevin, I just have a question, and I'm not trying to like say you're wrong, I'm right here, but with the hologram piece, because I kind of, you and I are both Star Trek fans, and I took the hologram piece, particularly around Garibaldi. To me, it was very similar to TNG season 2 with Elementary Dear Data. That's
exactly what I was referring to.
Okay, that's kind of what I thought, because, you know, where they created Moriarty, more or less a hologram with the ability to take over the ship that was self-aware. I also think part of it is the same mistake LaForge and them made. They didn't truly understand what they were doing or what they were creating. They didn't understand that when they dumped the memory and personality patterns of Garibaldi and Sheridan into these holograms, because what's Garibaldi anyway? He's suspicious. He's going to investigate. He's going to figure out what's going on. And if you dump that memory, that personality, even into a hologram, what's that hologram going to do and how's it going to behave? Which is more or less kind of what they did to me in Elementary Dear Data when they dumped the ability to defeat Data into Moriarty. So I didn't so much have an issue with that. I think TNG definitely wrote it better. I will say that. I think TNG wrote it better. I think this is just the being a single act as in a vignette is what this suffers more from than anything.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think TNG did it better. In TNG, it was a pretty fairly new technology, you know, holodecks were a pretty new technology. And of course, you know, we don't know how new this is or not. It didn't seem like it was to me, but I could be taking that wrong. I find it almost laughable that, you know, within 500 years, no one else has done this and had trouble to the point where they would have either fixed the problem or knew not to do it in the first place. And okay, I missed some of the parts about how this was a desperate attempt. And I did find some of Justin's arguments pretty compelling, but it doesn't really change my view of it. I still think it's by far the weakest part of this episode, and it makes me not like the episode.
Nicole?
So I took it a totally different way than Justin did. I didn't think it was desperate at all. I thought it was actually very calculated. They flat out said they're going to target innocent people, civilians, on purpose to demoralize the enemy. So they knew what they were doing. They were being fucking assholes, basically. So I didn't think it was desperate. I thought it was calculated and pretty evil, because he flat out said, oh yeah, we're going to kill millions of civilians. We're going to demoralize them, blah, 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 blah. And also, I'm sorry, I don't care what kind of little fascist fuck I am, I'm not sharing my evil plan with anybody. So I really do think he was a dumbass for just telling everybody everything from the beginning, you know?
Justin.
Well, I guess the only thing I was going off of, and maybe I read the interaction wrong, but I think Garibaldi even confronted him about, you're pretty desperate, and he like nodded. Like I think the guy even admitted that they were duped, they were on a time crunch, and that, you know, there was going to be a massive war breaking out within hours, and he had to get something put together quick that would help show their side of everything. So even the guy even admitted to Garibaldi that they were acting out of desperation.
I love the fact that you can watch the same vignette and get completely different, because Kevin, you say that, you know, it was written pretty poorly, and I hear you. I think it's written really well, because everything that you brought up is talked about in the script. So to Justin's point, they're told that they have 5 hours before they do a preemptive strike. And the reason why they're going to do a preemptive strike is because they are going to lose. And so they have to be preemptive. So they've got 5 hours to do this. And the reason why they want to do this is because after the strike, they're going to look like assholes because they just nuked, you know, what do you say, 15 million people or whatever you said. So they want to be able to say, hey, look, we did this because the alliance is bad. We had to hit them first because the alliance is bad. And here's why. I also love that this scene is the exact answer and kind of counterpoint to the last scene. The last scene, we got the idiot talking heads saying that individuals can't matter. Individuals do nothing. We, again, psychohistory, foundation stuff, if you've read it, to where history is going to move no matter what. It doesn't take one person to do it. And in this one, it may be an artificial person, but Garibaldi changes things. He's the guy who pivots history. Whether you like where it pivots or not, we'll talk about in the next vignette. But he's the guy who does it. So I love that the scene answers that question too. And I just, it's so prophetic, and it's already been hit on enough, and I won't talk about it again. But this scene is so prophetic to what we're going to be dealing with for the rest of our lives and into the next generation. And that this was written in 97, and we're looking at now and going, oh shit, this is scary.
Mm-hmm.
That's some really good writing, and I can't get behind the whole, it's a bad, stupid idea. The other thing, the one thing again, with the plot hole about shutting Delenn up and not shutting Garibaldi up, I think that's answered in the scene as well, because again, to Justin's point, he's moving very quickly to a point where he doesn't even get out, hey, shut down the Garibaldi piece, before Garibaldi jumps in and says, hey, wait, blah, 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 blah. Garibaldi knows if the guy can complete his commands, he's gone. So he does what we saw when Ivanova was kidnapped by the Drazi. He does the vacuum cleaner salesman gig, where he's just like, ba-bum, 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 doesn't let the guy do anything to shut him down. Again, where I think Jerry Doyle does great in this scene because of that. So I just, everything, this plot is tight to me, and that's just where I'm at on it.
I agree, the acting's very good, and it's extremely prophetic, but yeah, I still have my original problem with it.
A little subjective. I love the fact that we actually don't agree on everything. It's good. Okay, so let's move ahead one more time. Well, actually two more times. Let's move ahead 500 more years after the Great Burn and talk about monks.
Can we get Justin to do his chanting again, though? Just to
Now it's time, Justin. Now it's time.
Iesu Domine, dona eris requiem.
Hold on.
Find me the gasoline.
Clatu verata nicto.
Nicole, what do you got?
I thought he was singing about donuts for a second there. Sorry.
For all you know, he was.
I just have to say, out of this whole episode and that whole scene with the monks or whatever, that line about faith sustains us in the hour where reason says we can't continue, I'm putting that shit on a sticky note and putting it on my computer, on my desk, like where I can see it, because that is such a beautiful, profound line. And it really kind of goes back to like the previous episode where Jakar was saying the humans create community, and is a thread we've seen throughout the show so far, is all of the alien races have always said the thing about the humans is that they never give up, they never stop, they always keep going, and they, you know what I mean? And I just thought it was kind of like almost like a nod to that theme that we've seen kind of throughout the episode. And I just really thought that line was like, if I wasn't a wuss, I'd tattoo that on me somewhere, but I'm a wuss, so I'll just stick it on a sticky note. But that the whole monk scene was weird. I don't know, but that line, it like, I had to rewatch it like 3 times and write it down, because it hit me like a ton of bricks. That was like my favorite part of the whole thing.
I actually love this scene for more than one reason, and I'll kind of walk through each of them individually here. It shows the repercussions of what happened in the previous scene. We literally bombed our asses back to the beginning and had to start over. And over time, Tolkien was famous for writing in one of the Lord of the Rings books, history becomes legend and legend becomes myth. And we see that on display here. We see them actually taking the story of Babylon 5 and almost making a religion out of it, which is something that we've discussed numerous times throughout the history of this podcast about the, you know, the deification of Sheridan. He died, rose again, and would ascend bodily into heaven. Ivanova the Strong, Delenn the Wise, and stuff like that. And it's, to me, it felt like a very natural progression, to where they even said themselves, almost everything was lost in the war. Everything. And So all they had were these oral traditions to go off of, which is where a lot of where modern religion comes off of, where these books that we sanctify, whether the Quran, the Bible, the Bhagavad Gita, whatever you want to, you know, look at, were written hundreds of years after the events supposedly taken place. And so a lot of it throughout time was oral tradition. And so even like the brother, Brother Michael was talking about how he was having this crisis of faith because he was no longer starting to believe that maybe any of this actually took place. Maybe Sheridan didn't, you know, never even existed. Maybe, you know, the Book of Blessed Lorien and all this stuff, where I just started, like, to me, this is when the whole episode finally started to click for me, was you saw this horrible time of what you even yourself, Kevin, said about us going through another dark age. And the only stories we have to tell are the stories of these people that over time, and you play a game of telephone long enough and the message gets changed and everything like that. So we get to a point to where these people are almost deemed to be religious figures. And to me, for what the episode was going through, it made 100 perfect sense because, you know, they're even through this, you know, Rome is back in control. They're trying to preserve all of human knowledge, and it's all about trying to rebuild a broken world. And then even you get into the story of the Rangers, where the Rangers are, they're going to come back and they're going to help us rebuild. And even, you know, Brother Allred said, if they're here, you're never going to know, because they're going to do it in secret and they're going to, you know, slowly rebuild things behind the scenes. And it turns out he was a Ranger the entire damn time. So they are there trying to rebuild. But you can't just drop in on a civilization like that and just give them everything they need to get back into space and to, you know, kind of pick up, you know, you have to slowly rebuild it over time, centuries, maybe even millennia, to get to the point to where they can finally stand on their own 2 feet and begin to walk again. And I think that the way the Rangers are approaching this by taking them through, you know, we're going to build it in the right way. So yes, they are right now deifying Sheridan and Delenn and Ivanova and all of that. But eventually it's all towards this goal of trying to rebuild humanity to be able to take, once again, reclaim their rightful place among the stars. To me, this is when I actually really started to enjoy the episode, was in this scene.
Kevin.
So I'll preface this by saying that, and I don't want to take away from Mike wanting to talk about him, but I'll just say that if you watched any TV in the 80s and 90s, you've seen Roy Brocksmith before, either in science fiction or comedic acting. He's always a character actor, usually a guest star, and he's a great actor. And so I like the acting in this episode overall. I like the casting. What I don't like is, you know, yes, the overall arc of Babylon 5 is hopeful, and it's about faith, like we've talked about. But the fact that humanity falls this far is so demoralizing in the writing. It's not frankly believable that we would fall this far from a war. Maybe that's wishful thinking. Maybe I'm more hopeful than I should be. But, you know, in this context, it's very depressing. And it kind of goes against what Babylon 5 is all about. And I realize in the next vignette, it's going to swing the other way. I get that. But and I do like the Ranger aspect of this. I think that's kind of cool. But the overall, you know, we've not only fallen to the fact that we're not in space any longer, we don't even know what a motor is. And all of our writing is, I mean, we're completely in the worst dark age that anyone could imagine. That part of this is just, for a lot of reasons, I don't like the writing.
Nicole.
So as a grew up Catholic, went to Catholic school, I couldn't help but chuckle at them basically writing the Bible again. Like, that's what it made me think of. It made me think of, like, oh, they're writing the Bible. And then, you know, Ivanova the Great and, you know, the Blessed Sheridan, these are the saints and these are the apostles. Like, it just, it was kind of giving me flashbacks to CCD and like Catholic high school. I was like, oh my God, they're rewriting a Bible. But instead of, you know, Jesus, it's Sheridan. And you know what I mean? It was, and it just made me laugh knowing that Sheridan is a full-on atheist. Like, it just cracked me up. Like, I was like, this is it. It almost was just too funny for me to focus on anything else. I loved it.
Nicole, it's still a better book than the God Bless the USA Bible.
Yes, accurate. Well,
and it was a little bit Bible with a little bit like Ford Taurus owner's manual, it sounds like.
Yeah, very much so.
Also, like comic book. I mean, even Lorien was in there. Like, you know, I was just like, wow. Like, it just really, again, these religious themes we've seen throughout the show, it cracked me up. I was like, okay, JMS, I see you.
Justin.
This is JMS telling a lot of personal story, I think, within this scene as well, because it's, if you look at this from a sociological perspective, it's a natural progression of when you have a long oral history that nobody's bothered to write down or have been incapable of writing down for a very long time. So when they finally start writing down the lessons that they've been told over generations, yeah, some of these characters are going to be deified. And I'm not completely going against any particular religion. I have a faith that's my own, you know, but, you know, it's just a natural way of looking at things where, you know what? Yeah, some of these gods and some of these people that have been revered throughout a lot of human history could have very well been based upon real life people who have just been deified over the millennia. So it to me, the whole thing of us having to completely start over and of us having to rebuild our civilization from the bottom up and almost rediscover everything. And then we later find out we're not really rediscovering it. The Rangers are kind of feeding it to us bit by bit. But having to rediscover everything, to me, just makes a lot of sense for this. And it's, to me, it's good writing. And one thing that I'll kind of say now that I've noticed over the course of our discussions, and this isn't targeting any particular individual or any particular people, I feel like some people don't like certain things within this episode because it's uncomfortable to watch or it's unpleasant. To me, that doesn't make it bad writing. To me, that actually makes it very good writing. No one wants to sit there and watch Schindler's List and think, oh, this is great entertainment. No, it's supposed to make you uncomfortable. It's supposed to make you question things. You're not supposed to like a lot of what you see. And to me, I think that's what makes this a pretty well-written episode.
Blake.
Okay, I had to wonder there for a minute where we were headed with Schindler's List. That one threw me for just a second. I was going to point out, it's interesting when you look at Babylon 5, particularly this episode with the interweaving of religious themes and theology, and it's been there through all four seasons. And looking at the creator of Babylon 5 and knowing his personal pieces from his biography, being part of a religious cult, getting away from that, then getting into being an atheist, at the same time, you've got Star Trek created by Roddenberry, who was someone who started out as a Southern Baptist, rejected religion, and had this edict that there would be no human religion in Star Trek. Even going so far as to, there was a script for TNG where the writers referenced a marriage and he got pissed about it because marriage was a religious institution. And he did not believe that in Star Trek, in that era of humanity, there would be religion amongst humans. They could get away with it with aliens enough, but not within humanity. So I think it's interesting how two writers and creators took the shows and how they treated religion and theology. And I give it credit to JMS. The way he put religion in here, even as an atheist, was in a way that was so respectful and honestly worked throughout the entire series the way he did it. And some of the best discussions we've even had on this podcast have been around some of the theological and religious connotations and moral and ethical pieces he built around those things within this series. So I think even 30 years later, it still works.
I posted on Facebook what people's thoughts were on this. And Tim says, for an atheist, JMS sure does love his monks. But for me, every vignette as we move forward, I like more. And it's mostly all been said here, but I do love the fact that this is how it would happen. If we got bombed back to the Stone Age, to everyone's point, the one institution, whether you like it or not, that's going to be around will be the Holy Roman Empire. Well, not the Holy Roman Empire, but the Roman Church. The Roman Catholic Church is what I was going for there. And so that would be the first thing that people would huddle towards, is religion and the idea that this is an organization that can help us go. But I also love the fact that, as we get told in the episode again, they're not a part of the Catholic Church. the Rangers have requested that Rome recognize them, and Rome has once again said they're not recognized. I have no doubt that they actually didn't request that, but they're telling the monks, hey, we're trying to work with Rome here. So it's just that little stuff, again, a dropaway line in the script that really makes this whole plot tight. To the point of, Kevin, to your point, JMS was asked, does the Great Burn mean that B5 ultimately failed? And his response, and take it or leave it, but here's the response of him, is the fact as I see it is that no one and nothing will ever solve all of our problems at once, now and forever. People will always be people. You can't wave a magic wand and fix it all. Yes, there was another way, but had the shadows not been stopped by our characters, there literally wouldn't have been a human race at all anymore. Yes, there was a war, and many died in it, as tends to happen in war, but the nominal right side in it came out on top, which would not have been the case but for Garibaldi's simulacra giving them the leg up on things. We have had, continue to have, and will always have wars and grief and struggle. We will climb up and fall down. But each time we climb a little higher, and in the end, we do build the world that our ancestors would have wanted us, and we do leave the cradle at last, and we take our place among the stars, teaching those who will follow us. And for my money, that's as happy an ending as we or anyone can ever hope for. The other piece with that, too, will go along with his, is I think this, to Justin's point, is the vignette that really does hammer everything home. You've got hope in each one of these, whether it's the guy from Mars saying, hey, we got our independence, let's look forward to that, to Delenn is talking about how we need to continue to remember what how we got here, to the last one where, again, Garibaldi being that guy who stopped these idiots from causing too much bloodshed, and now we've got the monks building up hope too. So every one of these has a hope through line, which I really do enjoy, and obviously the next little piece will kind of hammer that home as well too. Blake,
I just wanted to comment a little bit on behind the scenes. You mentioned with Tim saying JMS liked his monks. So around the same time he was putting this together, he was writing a play that was set around medieval England and involved monks. And he admitted that he had just ordered a few $100s worth of stuff from Amazon, which at that time, a few $100s was not that easy to do on Amazon.
Remember when Amazon was just books back right? in the day?
Right.
Before you could get anything you wanted. But he put this together and was doing this research on monks into that. And then all of a sudden, there's monks into this, and he's going a little bit further down the road. He goes, oh, crap, this is Canticle again, which is another work that kind of explores the same idea of monasteries rebuilding after humanity basically suffers a massive disaster. And then he starts getting into the foundation references and even debated changing it a little bit to get it out of there, but ultimately went with this one the way it was. And I think it was better for it. The other option was he was going to look at making it set in like a university, ruins of a university type setting. And I think the monastery actually worked better, because even thinking back to Brother Theo and Brother Edward, their order was dedicated to data and science and preserving information. So this could easily be taken as an offshoot of what their order was, even if not officially recognized by Rome. Assholes. Yep.
Damn assholes. The other thing I love about the behind the scenes is while they were working on this script and everything else, there was a convention that they were at. And so JMS said at the convention in 97, by the way, if you want to flip Stephen first, and you get to this before leaving the con, get to him before leaving the con, give him the following message from me. Tell him Joe says this: don't worry anymore about using mini secure cam style coverage in Act 3. I've come up with another approach where I can cover it in dialogue to let you do whatever you want in the camera, so you'll have the flexibility that you want. Here's a use of a convention you haven't seen much before. So I guess poor Steven was going to have to figure out how to do all of that in one shot with a secure cam. But as we saw, we had the little Roman numerals, which was kind of cute as the cameras moved around.
I'm not going to lie. I thought the Roman numerals were some kind of code I tried to work on for a little while. I did. I thought, and I went back and I watched the episode again to try and see if there were any clues throughout the entire episode that maybe there was some kind of like, you know, drink your Ovaltine type message that was being broadcast throughout this episode. So it kind of roped me in there in my conspiracy ways.
The one other thing I wanted to throw out that just popped in my head that I forgot to mention earlier is there's an assumption here that all of humanity got nuked back to the Stone Age. That's not the case. It's Earth. Because even the Ranger, who is a Ranger who obviously was recruited from somewhere else or he wouldn't be a Ranger, is a human. And he's talking about, hey, this guy who's a little bit too questiony of what we're doing down here. Maybe we want to look at recruiting him. So humans are still going, and I bet you there's still a lot of human colonies out there. This is rebuilding Earth, not the human race.
Yeah, I think it's probably fair to assume that Mars didn't follow the same path that maybe Earth did, you know?
That almost makes less sense then, because you would have, you know, people from other colonies coming back to Earth. None of that makes any sense then.
It's in the dialogue again. And again, you can like it or not, but it's in the dialogue, because he actually says, the main monk says, that if we try to push science too fast, they'll reject it because science is what got us here. So if you have aliens landing, they're going to reject those guys again because science.
No, that doesn't. That I'm sorry, that doesn't make any sense. You wouldn't.
If the Rangers told them no, Kevin, no, don't go do this. We'll take care of it.
You wouldn't have 1,000 years of dark ages. You know,
500.
Okay, fine, whatever. Because you got to figure there was a lot of years after what we saw before they got back to where they were. So I'm just throwing out a number, but throw out whatever number you want. We had at least 500 years, you know, half a millennia of dark ages, and you've still got human colonies all over the galaxy that have the ability to come to Earth and interact with the people on Earth. You would not have this. This doesn't make sense.
There's a simple solution that makes it make perfect sense. The Rangers are making sure that doesn't happen. Again, as our Ranger lead said, if we give them all this tech right now,
they're interfering, and that wasn't supposed to be what they would do.
Okay, well, things change in 500 years, as we've seen. But I mean, here's the thing, and here's the thing, and Justin made this point clear, is if you like this episode, you'll find ways to make it work. If you don't like this episode, you'll find ways not to make it work. And this is a very divisive episode. I mean, it's not just us. Since 97, this episode has been extremely divisive, but I think it's written really well. And I that's how I see it.
Kevin, we'll talk more about it next week.
I'd rather not. No, I'm kidding.
You're right about the divisiveness. And I mean, I personally kind of feel divided about it myself, because there are a lot of things in this that I personally do and also don't enjoy. And like, this is one of those scenes. Like, this scene is the highlight of the whole episode for me. And I personally really like it because, you know, talking about tropes or reoccurring themes that you find in fantasy and sci-fi, the notion of the modern world being built on a much more advanced world that came before it, somehow fell to the catastrophe. You know, it's Lord of the Rings, it's Wheel of Time, it's even in Halo, the story now, if you can keep your head into that mythology at this point. And I actually really like that concept. You know, that's one of those things that's really engaging, that I could go out and dig up a spaceship in my backyard or something along those lines if I want to be really simple about it. But at the same time, there are things like what Kevin is struggling with that I'm right there with him. The fact that I can try to spin an idea or a reason for why other humans that weren't bombed back into the Stone Age, you know, wouldn't be showing up on Earth to help the Earthlings get back on their feet. It can be a case of the Interstellar Alliance is preventing it, or the Rangers are preventing it from happening for whatever reason. I don't buy it. I'm just right there with Kevin on that. It doesn't feel to me like any explanation I can come up with just sits very well. And I had that kind of same issue with the previous vignette about the AIs, and, you know, ostensibly I like a lot of what goes on in the vignette, but as an overall concept on that one, I had more of a problem with it for the same. So it's, you know, I guess I just say, like, this whole episode is like highs and lows and weird contradictory thoughts to me that hold it back in my mind.
I couldn't agree more, Mike. I mean, there are things in this episode that's laudable, and then it just falls apart under any scrutiny whatsoever to me. Even though there's good themes and good messages, the whole thing just does not work.
JMS said, some people probably would offer to help, but if technology is now suspect, some may not want that help. Other colonies might be of the screw them, they got what they deserve perspective. Often politics gets in the way of charity. So that was JMS's explanation of it. And I'm thinking that this conflict wasn't limited to Earth either. I'm thinking both sides would have had colonies, even though it said the colonies were mostly on the other side. I'm thinking both sides would have had forces in space and off planet. So this conflict may have gone and likely did go beyond the destruction of Earth. So who knows what colonies were left or what their attitudes may have even been at that point, given whatever happened within the larger scale, keeping in mind we got what a one-day snapshot out of all of this.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if there was more context and more color added, maybe it would make sense and feel better. But
yeah, I definitely agree each of these could be expanded with more information and more depth, which could make it better. I definitely will not fault it with this format doing this many different scenes. Something had to be a trade-off, and I think some of that depth and some of that world building around each of these was sacrificed for that. I can definitely understand that perspective. And I could easily see if we were looking at this in a different context, like with how they're producing television today, each one of these scenes on their own could be like a standalone special release of two or three episodes to explore the context and all that depth around them.
Justin.
I guess my question to the people who think that the Rangers were wrong for holding humanity back in the way that they were, in Star Trek, did the Vulcans holding humanity back make any more sense than this? Because it's kind of the same thing the Vulcans did to us in Star Trek.
I want Nicole to chime in on that one. Nicole, do you feel that how the Vulcans handled this in Enterprise?
Let me give you my 10-point dissertation on the Star Trek, okay?
The Star Trek.
Wow.
Because I'm so knowledgeable and well-versed in it.
On that note, let's move ahead a million years to the final little bit with our Vorlon human buddy.
Yes, we finally discovered true fashions.
Justin, what do you got?
I, for one, applaud Brian Cranston for his acting in this role, and I'm just joking. But
ironically, Brian was in the show, but not in this episode.
Yeah, not that episode. I know JMS has a lot of ties to Superman, and this gave me total Krypton vibes the entire time watching this. Like, the world's gonna end. I think even says in there, the world man in fire, but not in darkness. And he's sending off the knowledge of humanity out into the universe, and they're gonna go out. And yeah, to me, it just kind of felt like a lot of Superman undertones to it. And the question I had coming out of this, and I think it'll be addressed beyond the rim, so I won't know for who knows how long now, because will I actually go back and listen to a lot of this bullshit? I don't know. Are the human Lons now going to go out and be the new first ones for the galaxy? Or did those fuckers travel back in time and become the Vorlons that then helped guide? Like, is the timeline cyclical now?
Well,
that's one of the batshit crazy things that I was thinking
is that
watching
this. A prediction or a...
Or just a mind fuck, one of the three.
It's all of it. Like I was sitting there thinking, oh my God, is this, you know, all this has happened before, all of it will happen again. So now the humans go back in time, become the Vorlons, and then set the stage for the rest of development it just repeats itself over.
You've been watching BSG too much.
Hold on, I was gonna say
it's my favorite show, so you can't you can't blame me for thinking that way.
I was gonna say put me in, coach, because he looked less like a Vorlon and more like the leader model of Cylon in the original 80s Battlestar.
That's true. Yeah. That is so true. Yep,
totally.
Or Dot Matrix from Spaceballs.
There you go. But I think to that point, Justin, the way I read it, and this is talked about in Expanded Canon, which, again, take it or leave it. We already talked about Expanded Canon last week, which, by the way, I will apologize and say JMS's wife didn't write that abomination. It was actually JMS who wrote that one. She wrote a different story. I got yelled at in the comments about it. But in the Expanded Canon, New Earth is actually the old Vorlon homeworld, and they go and take the Vorlon homeworld for their own and become the new first one. Also, JMS does say, because he was asked, he's like, what other races make it into being, you know, a different kind of entity? He said, humans made it. Obviously, we saw that. The Minbari make it. The Narn and the Centauri, to Kosh's point back three seasons ago, don't make it. Doesn't mean they get wiped off the face of the universe, but they're never going to evolve into that.
In that higher state of being.
But Minbari and humans do. And to Mike's point with the Mumu, it's a human face rather than a Vorlon encounter suit. So I don't think they go back in the past. Although that'd be a fun little fanfic.
I couldn't help but think that. I'm sorry.
I know. I get you. I mean, we've done time travel before, so it's not the first time. Blake?
Just another fun little connection with how I like where this episode does callbacks. Back at season one, another one of those lovely episodes we had some discussion around was Mind War with everybody's favorite Jason Ironheart. And at the end, after he ascends into this higher level of being, at the end, he says, "You will see me again in a million years." And you have this flash forward now to a million years in the future. And humanity has reached that point of what Ironheart did in season one. They have become this higher being with more of the first one style, which I think is just an interesting, again, callback to things that have come before through season one with these through lines to here. And I think that was intentional from JMS. He was very much making a point with this episode and with the plan. And I think it truly does come out with the end credit card of Faith Manages. And this episode was him delivering a message to his critics and to everyone who said it wouldn't work.
Yeah, and he actually was asked, and he's supposedly, when they wrote Infection and when they wrote the Ironheart episode, this was a plan. This was the plan. Now, was it going to look like deconstruction? Potentially not. But the plan was, yes, in a million years, the humans will evolve to where Ironheart was at. And with Infection, even though Emily thinks it's better this episode, with Infection, the whole point the show was going to wrap around to the idea that we do make it. We do make sure that even when the sun goes boom, Marilyn Monroe will still be around. Just don't watch Blonde. It's a really fucking terrible movie. Nicole.
Well, I don't know if I want to admit this, but I had no fucking clue what was going on at the end.
It's really hard sci-fi. It really is.
Yeah, Justin's fucking conspiracy theory train there confused me even more. So this is what I like. Okay, so I was confused on who the guy was. I was like, who is this fucking guy? Is he an alien? Is he a human? Is he a Vorlon? Is he a Minbari? What is happening here? Then all I really understood or got out of the whole thing was he went away in a fucking, what are those called? A time jump hole thing. What are those called again?
A jump gate?
Yeah, jump gate. He went into a jump gate and then everything exploded.
A time warp.
I was like, what just happened? I know the world ended and I know there was a blue little square that went off into the sky, but I'm like, what the fuck is happening? And it makes sense because if this is hard sci-fi and I don't know shit about sci-fi, I was so confused. And I was like, okay, am I stupid or am I just really like not getting it? And then he gets in the suit and I'm like, but wait a second. That's a Vorlon suit, but he looks like a Minbari and a person. Is he another Valen? Like, I was so confused. So
can I sci-fi mansplain another trope to
yes,
you?
Yes, please sci-fi mansplain to me because I don't know what the fuck is happening.
Before Scott starts, please leave your comments in the section.
I asked first.
And I said,
Scott's about to mansplain yeah. again.
And I permissioned it.
Yes. In this case, I am okay with you mansplaining it to me because I have no clue what fucking happened.
So the idea here, and this happens in sci-fi, it's a trope. It absolutely is if you evolve long enough and you become something other than a corporeal being. So you become energy, which is what the Vorlons were as well, too. So the idea is, no, they're not Vorlons, but they've evolved to the same place the Vorlons were. And JMS does point out that once you get to this level, it's basically immortality.
Yeah.
So he's a human, but humans don't exist anymore. At least this sect of humans don't exist anymore. Okay. They're that.
Well, and when Blake brought up the Ironheart thing, I was like, oh, they became. Okay, I get
they
that.
They became
now.
All over the place.
Yeah, they did. But like, also, I was still really confused.
There was a mass becoming.
Yeah. So thank you for mansplaining.
It was like a Jackson Pollock painting. It was everywhere.
Well, and on the subject of tropes, so the other one is that before he became, at the end, he collected the entire sum of human knowledge into a USB drive that he sent off into the universe, and those show up in about every third episode of Star Trek.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true.
So,
is this another BSG thing where they...
Yes.
Yeah.
They're all head sixes, yes. I don't understand. I still don't understand how BSG ends, but yeah, sure.
Wait, I think I know what that is. Battlestar Galactica?
Yes, there you go. Good job.
Only because she played the board game.
That's the only reason I know anything about it is because the board game, exactly.
Well, Scott, when we finish up season five and we come back and do our Battlestar reboot podcast, I'll help you understand exactly why it didn't make any sense.
Oh, great. No. I think I'll make the first three seasons and go, I'm out.
Come on.
When they do the cock tease of Earth and then say, oh, wait, that wasn't the real Earth.
There's spoiler another alert. Earth. Stop
oh,
it.
Whatever.
Yeah.
That wasn't the real Earth. Sorry.
If you watched it in the 80s, I think they did the same thing then. So.
In the 80s, they wind up on Earth, and it's called Battlestar 1980. And it is
Galactica terrible. 1980. It's awful.
Thank you, Galactica 1980.
It's right up there with Crusade, but we'll talk about that later.
Well, 1980 turns out to be also their budget number for that series.
Yes. Yes. Kevin, what do you got?
I don't have anything profound to say about this scene. I don't love it. I don't hate it. Hopefully we make better choices than the Vorlons did, and that's about all I got for it, other than it. I don't know why it makes me uncomfortable, but it, for some reason it does, and maybe I'll be able to figure that out at some point. But I guess I'm just past the point of liking this episode, so. And it's not like I'm not trying to like it. Maybe I am, and I don't know it. But this last scene doesn't really hit for me one way or the other, to be honest.
Yeah, I'll jump in and say this because somebody alluded to it earlier, and I've kind of crystallized my thoughts on this a little bit as an overall feeling of why maybe this episode doesn't jive with me so well. It's the fact that it sucks to watch vignette after vignette of humanity continuing to suck.
Yeah. Okay.
Until you get to the end. Good.
Yep. That's how I feel about it. Yes. That's perfect.
So the last thing I'll bring up here too is the little piece at the end, which we all saw and we've already kind of talked about a little bit, the idea that this is dedicated to all the people who predicted that the Babylon Project would fail in its mission, Faith Manages. And the idea there, as we've already discussed, it was going to be canceled, and we do get a season 5, which we'll start talking about here in a few weeks. But I do like what JMS says about that little piece, because a lot of people were like, was that just you raising a middle finger? And Justin, you said it was a middle finger. It absolutely was a little bit too. But I do like how JMS says, and this actually kind of goes with the whole episode too, with the theme. And I think to Mike's point as well, there will always be short-term setbacks, but as long as we climb back a few inches higher than we were before we fell down, we keep moving toward the goal of becoming a better people and getting off the planet, taking our place among the stars. While it's vaguely possible that I may see a Mars colony sometime within my lifetime, I know I'll never live there. That ain't the point. It isn't victory if I do it, and a failure if I don't. It's if we don't do it, it's a failure. And then he continues to talk about how the idea that in 10 years' time, back in 97, the show will remain. The naysayers will go away, but the show will remain. Now, if you're on the B5 message boards, there's some naysayers still out there. But the idea is that we do grow and we will get to somewhere else. And that's the same thing with the show. Everyone said it would fail every single season, but it was able to make it. And we'll see what happens when it did make it to that final season. Anybody else got anything for deconstruction before we jump into questions and predictions? Okay, let's get our questions and predictions from our newbies. And Justin, I have your three already, which was, why was Sheridan's death a mystery? What was the situation with David, which is Delenn Sheridan's son? Mm-hmm. And did Sheridan, and this is actually Nicole's question, I believe, did Sheridan know that he was sacrificing Garibaldi? Mike?
Did we need to talk about the final scene of Delenn and Sheridan?
Oh, I guess we could.
I don't know that there's much to say other than
pillow talk.
It's a bit confusing whether this is a separate scene or whether Sheridan dreamed up this entire episode during post nut clarity. But
Jesus, he became all over the place. Justin, you have something to add?
Honestly, I wrote down in my notes, and this is one of my questions.
You wrote down number one question.
Well, I have thoughts about that on that, but I'll save that for later.
He does another monk chant.
That's beyond the rim.
Yeah, or maybe around the rim. But okay, so
you were doing so well.
My number one question is: did we get Dallas'd in this episode? And for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, you can skip the entirety of the show. One of the major characters gets killed at some point during the show.
Did you just yell at me about making a BSG spoiler and now you're going to spoil Dallas?
He didn't say who.
Nobody's going to watch it.
Right.
That's true. Nobody's going to watch it. But then in the final episode, that character ends up being alive. And the whole part of that after that was just another character's dream.
Roseanne did the same thing.
Roseanne did the same thing. So like my question is was this all just because he even sit there and say that, oh, I was just thinking about the future. Was this all just in Sheridan's head? That was my number one question.
It's totally the meme format where it's the man and woman laying in bed and the woman's looking all angry and she's like, he's probably thinking about other women. And then there's Sheridan like imagining fucking...
Will people still like me in a million years?
Will I be a warlord?
Turning into pure energy and wearing a moo-moo.
Can I be a warlord?
My wife walked through the living room as I was watching this episode and she goes, how is she not poking with that bone? And that was the input I got on that one. Since we're spoiling stuff, Maggie shot Mr. Burns, by the way.
I was totally going to say this.
Again, Gen Zers, this was a thing.
The lion is Jesus?
The lion is Jesus. Let's keep going. Emily, questions, prediction.
Question one, what the fuck was that?
Jesus Christ.
Question two, how have we spent 2 hours talking about this episode that was so awful? I don't even have a prediction. I don't know where season 5 is going to go after that horrible ending. I seriously, season 4 has been such a struggle for me, and that was just not a good way to end it.
I'm looking forward to the comments section on this one so much.
Oh, God, I have no predictions for season 5 because my brain just still hurts. It's debating on if it can handle season 5 at this point because season 4 was just not good for me.
Buckle up.
Oh, Christ on cracker.
Jesus. Emily will be on our season 4 recap show. And if you want to discuss with her her love for season 4, make sure you click that notify button so you can be notified when we go live.
And I need to start rewatching it so I'm prepared for that stupid live. And it's going to be a long ass 2 weeks of hell.
Any predictions aside from the fact that you may not make it through season 5?
Can we get more Patreon funds to pay for my therapy bill for this?
If you want to pay for Emily's therapy, and by the way, let's be honest, all of us need it too. So if you want to pay for everyone's therapy, be a Gray 17 Gray Council member, and we would really appreciate that. Or if you're just, if you work for BetterHelp and you want to make a sponsorship, we're here for it. We're all in.
Yeah, mine's not cheap.
Justin, any other questions and or predictions?
I got a couple.
A couple.
What led to the destruction of Babylon 5 in 2282? Question number one. Now, there's, like I said, all the speculation about the death of Sheridan. Was he on the station when he died? Because Lorien told him he had 20 years. He never promised he was going to die of natural cause. So is that what took out Sheridan, was the destruction of Babylon 5? Did the captain or the president or whoever go down with his ship? Or station, come at me, bro. As we were talking about post-coital thoughts, at what part, and I guess I'll throw this question out to the group, which scene, if this is all in Sheridan's head, what scene do you think he nutted during? Was it the Vorlon scene at the very end? Who knows?
Justin, I'm going to take your disgusting question, and actually, I'm gonna go with this. We already know what Kevin said was his least favorite and, I guess, kind of favorite vignette. I said mine. So everyone else, what was your least favorite vignette and what was your favorite vignette? Blake?
I'm just trying to get the visual out of my head of Sheridan nutting to one.
I'm trying to change the subject.
I think my least favorite is probably going to be the one with the monk.
Really? Okay.
And my favorite would be the one that takes place just before that with the holograms, just given especially the way that can relate to now.
Emily, which was your favorite?
Seriously, dude.
The end credits.
Basically, yeah.
What was your least favorite, Emily?
I mean, like, the whole thing, but...
Jesus.
The whole, like, Sheridan and Delenn in the bed, I mean, she didn't look very satisfied, so I'm assuming they were having a conversation and nothing else, so that was awkward.
I continue to go back to what Ryan from Yum Yum said, and that is that Sheridan is not good in bed. That's made clear in this entire series.
Maybe they just sleep naked. Who knows? Don't judge their life.
I thought the whole monk thing was weird. I don't really like any of it. It's hard to pick the worst.
Mike, what was your least favorite?
my least favorite was the computer simulation scene. I just, the whole thing feels just so weirdly hokey, and I can't justify it any more than we haven't beat the dead horse at this point. Like, the program Garibaldi becomes self-aware and powerful enough to overthrow the space Nazis.
And which one did you like?
The monk. The monk okay, scene. The monk, yeah. Yeah. Made no bones about it. I thought it was the best one.
Nicole, which one did you not like?
I would say my least favorite is the monk one. And my favorite one was actually 100 years after when they had the panel and Delenn showed up.
Okay. And Justin?
Least favorite has to be the McLaughlin group at the very beginning of the episode.
Yeah, okay. No one liked that one.
Yeah. And then my favorite are the monks, for sure.
Although, Kevin, I think you said that was your favorite one, the McLaughlin group.
No, all I said was the episode did not become objectionable until after it. That's all
gotcha, I said. Gotcha. Okay, Justin, now we've tried to divert from the nut job. So, any other questions or predictions?
No, that's it, bro.
Thank you. Okay. And also, by the way, one thing we will do on the season 4 recap that we've done before is we will ask our newbies for their season 5 predictions as well, too. So we'll get that as well in our recap show. And Nicole, questions, predictions?
Will we ever find out more about the Great Burn is one question. And then are we going to find out how Sheridan died? I think Justin kind of asked a similar question, but like some of the things that like obviously we'll probably, I would assume in the next season we'll learn. I guess this would be a prediction. I guess we'll see the telepath war maybe. But as far as beyond that, I don't know if we'll see any of that. So just curious if we'll hear any more about that. Yeah, I don't really have much else.
Great. Well, we'll go ahead and leave our newbies here until next week when we discuss the TNT movie In the Beginning. And then again, we'll be back the week after for our live season 1 recap, our season 4. Man, I went back in time, much like Justin. Our live season 4 recap show, which will be on our YouTube channel and then also release as a podcast after that's done. So we'll be back after the credits for our Beyond the Rim segment for those who don't care about spoilers or already know what happens next. And between now and next week, please be sure to click all the links, check out our social medias, go in there and tell us which one of us was wrong of the split between the half of the group that liked this episode and half the group that didn't like this episode. And then also on our Twitter account, be sure to vote in the tournament for what your favorite season 4 episode was. And if you can, join us over on our Patreon, where we do also have our Discord, where we do talk B5 general conversations as well as spoilers. And and click all the buttons, leave reviews, do all that stuff too. Until next week, when we talk In the Beginning, I've been Scott, and with me has been
Blake,
Nicole,
Emily,
Justin.
I know, was it me? Oh, fuck. Yes. All right, Mike.
And Kevin.
See y'all next week. Thanks, newbies. Thank you for listening to Grey 17, a Babylon 5 podcast. You can find all the places to listen to and watch this podcast at anchor.fm/Grey17podcast or youtube.com/Grey17podcast. We want to hear from you, so join the conversation at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, or Patreon. Be sure to subscribe and leave a review where you are listening to or watching this podcast. Grey 17 is not affiliated with, and the podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by Warner Brothers or any other owners of the Babylon 5 copyright. All clips included in this podcast are the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders. They are included here for purpose of review, and no infringement is intended. The opening and closing themes are available from Falling Matter on YouTube.
And what's out there?
The Rim.
And beyond that?
The truth.
Welcome back to Beyond the Rim. This is a spoiler section for the episode, so if you've not watched past Deconstruction of Falling Stars or can't remember what happens next, this is where you should leave us. If not, we will talk about the questions and prediction, singular, that our newbies gave us. And Kevin, through the power of the internets, has left us for the night, so we will have Mike, Blake, and I here for the rest of this. So the one thing I wanted to bring up before we got into questions and predictions, guys, is the thing I was expecting that could be brought up that wasn't, and maybe it's because Jesse wasn't here tonight. Sheridan drops the name Captain Lockley, and no one caught that, or at least no one brought that up. Thoughts?
Yeah, I'm as surprised as you are. I thought there was going to be a question. I thought people would be listening for some kind of tip-off. Like, you know, they'd be listening like a hawk for it, actually, given we kind of I don't know. I guess I should say this. We, last week, I felt like we, as first ones, really leaned into kind of telling them exactly what was going to happen with Ivanova, when I felt like maybe we could have dicked with them a little bit harder. So we did kind of already tell them she was out in no uncertain terms. So I guess based on that, maybe they weren't so tuned into it. But
That's true. Well, they'll meet Captain Lockley here in a few weeks, so it'll be an interesting conversation. So let's dive into the questions. First question, and let's just kind of combine a lot of these together. So Nicole asks, do we find out how Sheridan dies? And also Justin asks, why is Sheridan's death mysterious? And then does he die with the destruction of Babylon 5?
Well, let's back up a bit and let's start with the destruction of Babylon 5, if you don't mind.
Please, I do not mind.
Because I don't think they're catching on to, and it's not really spelled out, is Babylon 5 is not destroyed in a battle or in some type of conflict. Babylon 5 is decommissioned and they blow it out of the sky because it's a menace to navigation. So nobody's on the station when Babylon 5 actually goes up.
Yeah, I couldn't remember specifically if that was the case or not, but that was the thought that was in my head was they don't say in any way that Babylon 5 met an untimely fate.
No, they actually say it's no longer necessary. To Blake's point, it served its purpose, and actually where it is no longer an important part of the galaxy. So it's just like, what they say, Blake? It's a navigational hazard.
Hazard, yeah. And I will say, there are a handful of episodes of any television show that get right in the feels of an emotional response.
Mm-hmm.
As we've mentioned before, Two Cathedrals with West Wing, Requiem with West Wing. Mm-hmm. Sleeping in the Light with that end theme when the shuttle is leaving and you see all of the different races' ships turn and follow it out. Gets me every time.
And the fact that it's JMS flipping the switch.
Yep.
So yeah, but in terms of the Sheridan piece, no, he does visit B5 before he passes. And what we'll learn is that he feels that his time is up. It's getting close to the 20 years. He can feel his life energy leaving him. And he decides to take one last look at the girl and goes over to B5 before he dies. But with the going to the mystery part, no one sees him die because he doesn't die. Well, I mean, that's debatable. I guess you could think he does die. My philosophy and theory is that Lorien comes back and picks him up and brings him to wherever the shadows, the Vorlons, and also the Jakar clone we find out in the road home is hanging out.
What about those soul hunters? They don't come and collect him?
The soul hunters are a massive plot point and hole for all five seasons. And River
they've
Souls,
got a massive hole, all right.
Yes, they do.
I wasn't even going to. Thanks, Mike.
Yep, you're welcome.
But yeah, so I do like the fact that it is mysterious. And you get that. I mean, we talked about the whole how history is revised and everyone plays with it and wants to see what they want to see. But we do get that in history, too, that some important figures just kind of disappear and people like to make up whatever happens to them at the end, depending on to fit their narrative. So for people who don't want Sheridan to be important, he dies on Minbar. He was an old guy. For others, he became a god. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
What was the situation with David? Blake, have fun.
So it doesn't really get into in the series, but the gift that Malari gave to Sheridan to give to his son had a Drak keeper in it. It was a urn with a Drak keeper. So the Drak attempt to take David.
And by Sleeping in the Light, it is told that David is fine.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's already past his 18th birthday when he was supposed to open the urn. So obviously something happens to, you know, protect David or get the keeper off of him or whatever. But unless it's in some kind of book that I didn't read, we never actually find out how that happened. We just know that by the time David is, 19 or so, he's okay. And of course, we don't get the David from the original plan, who is an idiot savant who brings the galaxy together. So that's fun. Will we ever find out more about the Great Burn? Because Nicole wants to know more about this, and Kevin does not.
Well, Kevin will be happy.
Yeah, we do not.
The Great Book Burning.
That is true.
Coming to a school library near you.
Especially in Iowa. Oh, God.
You know, you want to talk about whether or not it's plausible for a civilization to go back that far from their current stat or status. And I don't know, man. I have to think, I've seen some pictures of like what places like Egypt look like pre and post fundamentalism.
Mm.
it's not that far fucking off. So
no, and especially I mean when you think about it, if you basically nuke the planet or whatever they have at that point, and let's say you wipe out even a quarter of the population, that means entire countries fall apart. And so it's very easy to get into a dark ages. This is, I didn't want to go round and round with folks, but I think this is extremely plausible and depressing, but absolutely.
Yeah. This, I mean, then this is probably one of the, why in part, this is one of the scenes, like I said, that I actually liked in this episode. And one of the plot points I actually like, albeit, as you said, depressing. I do think it's very plausible that this kind of thing happens. And there's a lot of blank space left between this and the preceding vignette. But I mean, you could have a whole massive extremism of people purposely going out and destroying knowledge by an anti-religious sect. Who the hell knows?
But the Spanish Inquisition was
certainly not impossible.
I mean, shit, we had COVID for 3 years and I still can't go to Walmart after 11 o'clock at night. I had to buy eggs last night. They almost closed on me. It was bad. Did Sheridan know? I love that Nicole is just assumed that Garibaldi is going to get shot in the face. I love this. Did Sheridan know that he was sacrificing Garibaldi?
I would say probably yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sheridan's kind of a dick sometimes.
It's for all intents and purposes. I mean, one man's life versus opening the door to negotiating with terrorists. Like, what choice did he have?
No, he doesn't. And I mean, you see it in Garibaldi's face, too. He knows exactly what Sheridan's going to say, because he would do the same thing.
I was going to say, nobody on this show would understand it better than Mr. Garibaldi.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, well, shit. Oh, I can't wait for the Byron escapades. It's going to be fun. I bet you Nicole loves it. I bet you of anyone, Nicole's going to love the Byron stuff. We'll see how it goes. And then, to Justin's point, did we get Dallas'd? Was it all a dream?
No, we did not get Dallas'd.
No, but it was funny to bring up.
Yeah. And then finally, I mentioned this to Mike and Blake on the side chat when Justin was talking about what he was hoping to see in season 5. And now Nicole makes a prediction, we will get the telepath war in season 5. I'm like, oh, you guys are just going to love the fact that season 5 gives you nothing in terms of the telepath war. Nothing at all. It's going to be great. But yeah, no, we do not get the telepath war. You got to read 3 books to get that. I think that's one of the things that is in fandom, from what I can tell, the area that people feel like they really wish they would have got more out of, either in season 5 or in general, is that telepath war, because it gets built up all the way from season 1. Bester is obviously a very loved person to hate. And the fact that we don't get an ending to that entire set of stories, unless you read books, it's frustrating. But we won't see the telepath war at all. Nope. Sorry. We'll be back next week to discuss In the Beginning. And we will, I'm sure, have some interesting thoughts from our newbies about that. And then in 2 weeks, we will be talking about season 4. And you can come join us there and watch Emily try to figure out what she's going to talk about for an entire recap show. It's going to be great. So until next week, I've been Scott, and with me has Ben,
Blake,
and Mike.
And be sure to click all the buttons, like, subscribe, follow, and join us on social medias. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Bye.
But there's a time and a place for everything, and this is the time, and this is definitely the place for one hell of a party.
Do you wish to continue?